How everything around us is constantly in motion on some minuscule level. When a guitar is strummed, molecules are disturbed and vibrate at whatever frequency they'll vibrate at under those circumstances. Their kinetic energy creates sound,
Exactly.
Dancer says.
Another example of kinetic energy is when you crack a whip in one of several specific modes of motion. The sound it makes is because a portion of the whip is moving faster than the speed of sound, and it creates a small sonic boom.
I didn't know that. Now I'm jealous of a whip. The speed of sound is over 700 miles per hour. I don't make sonic booms. I want a whip. I like the idea of walking around making sonic booms everywhere. I can't believe he never told me this before.
This better be going somewhere.
Riordan says. It is, I say. Dancer doesn't waste time.
He's wasting mine.
Something's gnawing at the edge of my brain. I'm relieved to realize these folks died quickly and without suffering, because I just calculated the most likely trajectory of the Hoarfrost King's path from where I saw it disappear, and I was wrong about my first assumption. There's no way these folks saw it coming. None of them were facing the direction it came from. They died instantly, with no awareness of what killed them. I'm relieved. Unlike me, most folks don't seem to want to live their death in slow-mo. Mom always used to say she hoped she'd die in her sleep, easy and without pain. She didn't.
You're never going to believe what I discovered.
Dancer says.
I was staring straight at the results and still refused to accept it. I kept checking, running different tests, testing different objects. I went back and grabbed more Ziplocs and tested that stuff too. The results were the same over and over. You know what absolute zero is, right, Mega?
Like, where the feck I'm standing? I say, but I don't mean it, because if it was, I wouldn't be standing here. I'd be dead. I frown, studying the scene, trying to make sense of something. If they didn't see it coming, why were they screaming? Did they feel the same suffocating panic I felt at Dublin Castle before it arrived?
Isn't absolute zero theoretical?
Christian says.
Technically, yes, because all energy can never be removed. Ground state energy still exists, although laser cooling has managed to produce temperatures less than a billionth of a Kelvin. Again, what the hell is your point?
Riordan says.
Are you saying these scenes are being cooled to absolute zero? No. The only reason I brought that up was to illustrate the connection between extreme cold and molecular activity. And the fact that even at the most extreme cold possible, all objects still have energy of some type.
And, Joe says.
On a molecular level, the debris left by the Hoarfrost King has absolutely no energy. None.
That's impossible, I say.
I know. I ran the tests over and over. I tested multiple samples from every scene. I went to Dublin Castle, dug pieces of Unseelie from the snow, and tested them too.
He says.
They're inert, Mega. No energy. No vibrations. Nothing. They're motionless. Deader than dead. The things I was testing can't exist. Yet, there I was, holding them in my hands. Physics as I know it is being reinvented. We're standing in the doorway of a new world.
So you think it's drawn by energy and eats it, like fuel. Maybe it uses it so it can move through dimensions, Joe says. Dancer shakes his head.
I don't think it's that simple. Most of the scenes at ICE didn't have an impressive stockpile of energy. If it was after energy, there are an infinite number of richer places to fuel up. I speculate the absence of energy when it vanishes is a secondary and perhaps completely unintended effect of whatever it's doing, tangential to its primary purpose.
I got the same impression with my she-seer senses at Dublin Castle, that it wasn't malevolent or intentionally destructive. I sensed it was enormously intelligent and hunting for something.
What is its primary purpose?
Riordan says. Dancer shrugs.
Wish I knew. I haven't been able to figure that out yet. I'm working on it.
Well, what are we supposed to do? Joe says, looking around. There has to be something.
Stand around, hoping the bloody thing decides to appear while we're looking, then hit it with whatever we've got handy in the 2 seconds it's actually here in our world.
Christian says disgustedly.
At least I know what the Crimson Hag wants. Guts, preferably immortal ones.
He gives Riordan a look.
And I know what to use for bait. So do I,
Riordan says. What are you talking about? Joe says, looking between Christian and Riordan. What's the Crimson Hag? I realize she hasn't seen my Danny Daly, nor does she know Riordan was ever dead. She has no clue her boyfriend is immortal. I decide to save that bombshell for the perfect moment. I also decide I'm going to be spending a lot of time with Christian and Riordan, hoping the hag comes after them. I let her loose. I'm the one that has to send her back to hell. Riordan says to Dancer,
work faster. Get back in your lab and find me an answer. Dublin's turning into Siberia, and the thing just deposited a pile of frozen shit on top of my club.
At least it didn't ice the door, I say, cause then we couldn't get back in. Riordan gives me a look that says he knows I know the back way in.
Try a flamethrower,
Christian says.
Does the trick, till everything blows.
Speaking of which, any ideas what makes the scenes blow up? I ask Dancer.
Oh, I think it creates a kind of energy vacuum, where things get unstable. Like I said, physics aren't working right. It's possible objects reduced to no energy are brittle, and when disturbed by vibrations of objects around them, they explode. The lack of energy may also be the lack of glue necessary to hold matter together, except in these cases, they're shellacked in ice. Once that shell is compromised, everything comes apart. The larger the disturbance of molecules surrounding the scene, the more violent the explosion. You freeze-framing in to study the scene would generate a significant vibrational disturbance.
Sometimes I miss the most obvious things. How many scenes exploded when Riordan and me were fast mowing through them, and I never put two and two together? I ponder what Dancer just told me, crunch it with a few other facts, mix it all up good to see what I get. The Hoarfrost King leaves no energy behind when he vanishes. It's stripped from everything he ices. Rajon said that when the HFK iced places in Seelie, the Fae weren't just killed, they were erased like they'd never been. Both times I saw the HFK appear, all sound vanished. None of us could hear a thing. Dancer confirmed a third case of similar silence and hollow-sounding after-effects at the Weak Air event he witnessed. Why would sound vanish? Because everything stopped vibrating the instant the HFK appeared? Why would things stop vibrating? Because it was sucking energy? What exactly is the HFK doing? What attracts it to where it's being attracted? What is the fucking commonality? Until we figure it out, we have no hope of stopping it. We're sitting ducks. I examine the icy tableau before me. I need answers, and I need them now. Before I went into the White Mansion, I might have had a little time to play with, but since I've been gone, things in my city have gotten critical. There's too much snow, and the cold's getting too extreme. And if the HFK doesn't kill folks, cold alone will. How many hundreds, even thousands more people will die before we figure out how to stop it? What if it goes to the Abbey next? What if it takes Joe from me? What if everybody's generators run out of gas, and they all die holed up, alone? I sigh and close my eyes. A shiver. What I need to see is right here in front of me. I can feel it. I'm just not looking with the right eyes, the clear eyes that suffer no conflicts. I need a brain like mine and eyes like Riordan's. I focus on the backs of my lids, take the grayness of them and cocoon it around me. I make a bland womb where I can begin the process of erasing myself, detaching from the world. The one where I exist and I'm part of reality, and everything I see is colored by my thoughts and feelings. I strip away all that I know about myself, all that I am, and sink into a quiet cavern in my head where there is no corporeality, no pain. In that shadowy cave, I don't wear a long black leather coat, or skull and crossbones panties, or crack jokes. I don't love being a superhero. I don't think Dancer is hot, and I'm not a virgin, because I don't really even exist. In that cave, I was never born. I won't die. All things are distilled to their essence. I go inside my head and become that other me, the one I don't tell anybody about, the observer. She can't feel hunger in her belly or cramped muscles from being in a cage for days on end. She isn't Danny. She can survive anything, feel nothing, see what's in front of her for exactly and only what it is. Her heart doesn't break a little every time her mom leaves, and she holds no price too high for survival. I don't let go of myself and seek her often, because once I got stuck there, and she took over and the things she did, I live in terror that one day I won't get to be Danny again. But, fucking A, she's one smart cookie. Tough, too. She sees everything. It's hard to see like she does. Makes me feel like a freak. She thinks I'm a wuss, but she never refuses me when I come. I open her eyes and study the scene. She's a receiver. Things go in and come out. She processes. No ego or id. Nothing but a puzzle here. And all puzzles can be solved. All codes decoded. All prisons escaped. No price too high for success. There is an end, and there are means. And all means are justified. The facts, void of emotion, look completely different. Folks bang cans. Fists pump the air. Some clap. Others warm themselves. I pick and discard. I strip to bare essence. Their bodies are bent and moving in ways that suggest intended, even relaxed motion, not the instinctual, tense muscular and skeletal flexion of panic. Everyone whose mouth is frozen open appears to be making an elongated E. Their eyes are nearly closed, and the cords are tight in their necks. I couldn't see it, but she can. It's right there in front of us. It was there the whole time. She thinks it's obvious and I'm stupid. I think she's a sociopathic nut job. I have my answer, but can't rejoice in it because she doesn't feel. I close my eyes to detach, but she won't let me. She wants to stay. She thinks she's better equipped than me. I try to leave the cave, but she hides all the doors. I visualize brilliant lights in it, like those on top of BB&B. She turns them off. I open her eyes because I can't stand the darkness. Riordan is staring at me, hard.
Danny,
he says.
Are you okay?
He uses a whole unadulterated question mark. A bona fucking fide interrogatory that rises just like a normal person. And that simple thing penetrates. It surprises me the things that rattle her. It loosens her hold on me, and I slip free. I guess my sense of humor is more Danny, not her, than anything else about us, because when he cracks me up, just like that, she's gone. For a few fleeting seconds, I know I'm going to forget her again. I think she makes me forget her, and I won't remember until I need her, or I get pushed too far. Then I don't even know that anymore. I replay all my filed scenes, looking for and finding that single commonality it took me so long to see. It was right in front of me all this time, but I couldn't drop my preconceptions. I saw what I expected to see, and that wasn't what it was at all. Holy frozen frequency, Stancer, I say softly. It's drinking sound slurpees.
What?
Dancer says. None of them were screaming. All the folks I thought were yelling in fear and horror at the end were singing. The music changes beneath my feet. A heavy metal song just came on in Chester's, and the vibrations increase in tempo and intensity. I feel the blood drain from my face. If I'm right, and I am right, there are thousands of people below us in Chester's, and although I'm not real impressed with their choice of a lifestyle, the race we're in now needs all the humans we've got left. We've got to turn it off, I say. We've got to turn everything off right now. Dude, we've got to shut Chester's down. 36. Oh, the weather outside is frightful. Beyond the frost-edged window of my bedroom, fat snowflakes drift lazily to the ground. Unlike me, they know no urgency. At the Abbey, snow obeys a simple prime directive, fall without cease. It began 2 days after Sean went to work at Chester's, and has not stopped for 23. My heart suffers a similar accumulation, with chill piling in treacherous drifts and valleys. Despite our efforts to beat it back, winter claims more of our world with each passing day. Ours has dwindled to paths shoveled between waist-high white walls crusted by ice. I do not know how to navigate this new terrain. I fear my Nana's snow goblins lurk in these drifts, waiting to carry off those who stray into the blinding wintry white. Sean has not been able to reach the Abbey, nor have I been able to leave for 15 days. We venture into the countryside with hatchets and saws, only to procure timber from hard-iced, felled trees, so that we may keep our fires burning bright. We have run dry of gasoline. Generators squat in silent reminder of auspicious times we no longer enjoy. We have precious few candles, and lack ingredients to make more. If not for the batteries Danny spent obsessive weeks stockpiling as protection against the shades months past, it is possible we would all be dead, unable to protect ourselves from the amorphous apparitions that may yet lurk within our walls, although we've yet to glimpse one since the night Cruce was interred in his subterranean sepulchre. Some say the unseelie king took them with him when he left. One can hope. Night sees us gathered in common rooms to conserve supplies. It is impossible to say when the snow will stop. The sky is night black or storm-leaden, but for an occasional shaft of brilliant sunshine piercing clouds. If we do not soon remove the weight of accumulation from the roof of our chapel, we will lose both roof and interior supports. Ice will crush our altar, and drifts will take our pews. Early this morning, the rafters creaked and groaned a somber hymn as I prayed, God, grant me serenity, wisdom, strength, courage, and fortitude. But all is not snow at our abbey. Oh, no. All is not chill within or without our walls. My wing of the abbey is a temperature 65 degrees, with not one fire burning. My chambers are nearer 80, sweltering for one born and raised on the Emerald Isle. I mop my brow and tuck damp tendrils behind my ears. I unfasten the top button of my blouse and dab at my skin. Beyond the window, the sharp-shaved crystalline fire-world funnel towers over the abbey, glittering bright as diamonds in a capricious ray of sun. Between it and the perimeter wall of my bedchamber, snow is conspicuously absent. In that narrow boundary, grass grows. Grass by the saints! Green as St. Patrick's clover. Kelly green as the misshapen shamrock that symbolizes the mission and integrity of our order, to see, serve, and protect. Against the crumbling mortar flush to my bedroom wall, sultry flowers in every shade of boysenberry and orchid, cerise and byzantium, bend and sway with blossoms so heavy on delicate stems they droop and nod, deceptively dulcet on a breeze as conflicted as my soul. Temperate one moment, frigid the next. Were I to crank the window and part the leaded glass, the scent that drifted in would intoxicate me. The blossoms reek of spices that make me think of Persian carpets and far-off lands, where hookahs are smoked for breakfast, and sultans keep harems, and life is lazy, licentious, and short-lived. But well-lived, Cruce would say. I blot sweat from my palms, and smooth a blueprint on Rowena's stately desk. I must know, and I do not want to know, if what I have begun to suspect is true. Although the IFP is tethered to a piece of earth that has been fired to a kiln-smooth porcelain black gloss, were one to approach it, one would feel no heat. The fire world is contained. Yet, between the IFP and our abbey grows that loathsome grass despite the snow, that grass upon which Cruce lays me gently back in my dreams, amid fragrant blooms, where he makes me feel things for which I despise myself come dawn. I am not wise in the ways of geography. I know east when the sun rises. I know west when it sets. Rowena protected many secrets, clanking keys in the bracelet of power that remained on her wrist, held over our heads, until the day she died. I discovered a cash in her bedchamber 4 nights ago, when, desperate to resist another torturous slumber, I occupied myself by studying every inch of the Grand Mistress's apartment, seeking telltale clues of false panels or retractable floorboards. In the faux bottom of a centuries-old armoire, I found maps, sketches, and plans, many of places that baffle me, in which I am unable to divine her interest. Also therein, I found blueprints of the abbey on scrolls and bound in large flat volumes, both upstairs and underneath. It is the blueprint of the subterranean chamber and adjoining passages wherein the Shisadu was once entombed, over which I now place the transparent sketch I have prepared of my wing. I smooth them together so they meet, corner to corner, and press my tongue to the roof of my mouth in silent protest, a technique I perfected when young, to keep from crying out when lambasted by another's intolerable emotion. Cruce's chamber is beneath my bedroom. Begging the question, does the false summer that makes grass grow and flowers bloom come from the fire world adjacent, or the iced prince below? I decide maybe I can stand Raiden, at least today, because when I say shut Chester's down, the dude doesn't even ask me another question. He skirts the ice sculpture's perimeter and heads straight for the metal door in the ground. The ice ends some 15 feet from it, about which I'm real glad, because the back way in that I'm not supposed to know about is a long way from here. Takes a lot of underground navigating. And knowing him, since he heard I knew of it, he probably shut it down and had his men make him another one. But I'll find that one too. It's like a game with me. Him trying to hide stuff just makes me more determined to find it. I follow, happy he takes my word for things. Joe and Christian sure don't. They're behind me, peppering me with questions that Dancer isn't answering either. I think because he's still busy putting together all the ramifications of what we just figured out. Either that, or he's as obsessed as I am about getting every single thing in our general vicinity turned off. ASAP! I'm still missing a few facts that I don't think I can gather since the scenes all blew up. Speculation may be all we got to work with. I know the Hoarfrost King likes ice cream, but I don't know what flavor. And I'm pretty sure he's picky, or else we'd all have been iced months ago. I follow Riot into his office, where he cuts the power to the subclubs. With each tap of the computer screen, one more subclub dies, and it's all I can do not to hoot and holler, especially when the kiddie subclub goes dark and still. Lights dim, music stops. People, the feckin' sheep who should have pulled their heads out of their asses weeks ago and banded together to save our city, protest vociferously. Some just keep dancing, like nothing ever happened, like they're hearing music in their heads. Others shrug and get back to practically doing the dirty on the dance floor, clothes half off, like everybody wants to see their baby roach-slimmed butts. Can I talk to all the clubs at once? I say. You got some kind of PA system here? He gives me a look that says, nice try, like I'd ever let you address my patrons en masse. I snicker. He has a point. I could rant at these folks for hours. You got to explain, I say. They need to understand what they're up against. You got to tell them about the Hoarfrost King, and that they can't go outside and make noise or else they might die. And you got to tell them how the scenes explode, so if anybody leaves, they don't do nothing stupid with the frozen folks up there and get all cut up on shrapnel. And don't forget to tell them that even in here they need to stay as quiet as they can and... Riordan presses a button on his desk.
There will be no lights or music until further notice.
He releases the button. That's it, I say. Feckin' good thing he ain't writing the riot and rag. Through the glass floor, I watch folks rustle angrily. Many are drunk and don't like this new development. They want their bread in circuses. That's why they come here. Boss, oh, what the feck was that? Maybe you could, like, tell them not to leave or they'll die. He presses the button again.
Don't leave, or you'll die.
There's a pregnant hush then. Like they all think he's God or something, and folks and Faye stop everything they're doing and sit down. Only after a long moment do they begin talking again.
I think you should lock the doors, Joe says. Don't let them out for their own good.
I'd prefer they leave, less to draw it here.
If you want me to tell you what to do to keep this place safe, I say, you better keep them safe.
I thought you were disgusted by the people that come to my club.
They're still people. He presses the button again.
If you go outside, you will be killed. If you make noise, you will be sent outside. Don't piss me off.
Just like that, Chester's goes completely silent. Part 3. No lullabies to lay the children to rest. No hymns to mourn the dying. No blues to ease the pain. No rock and roll to live by. Without music, we would all be sociopaths or dead. The Book of Rain. 37. The Sound of Silence. A calm she sears to gather in the chapel beneath Creek and Eaves. Our sanctum could once scarce contain the half of us. Seated now between march and rows of majestic ivory pillars, those who remain are swallowed in voluminous, echoing silence, save the groaning of rafters and the hollow resonance of my footfalls as I walk the center aisle that leads to the sanctuary of the liturgical east of the church. Dull, despairing eyes follow my progress. My girls occupy the front 11 pews in the nave. The ghosts of cherished friends fill the rest. It was a hard winter, followed by the tease of stillborn spring. Now this incessant snow. I feel stronger in the chapel. Here, the divine defies the devil at our door. Faith is an unquenchable flame in my heart. Although twice Cruce has followed me here, these hallowed floors remain inviolate. He has not been able to enter. Reliquaries of polished ivory and gold, adorned with precious gems, attend the altar. More sheltered at shrines where once candles flickered, until we were obliged to purloin them for other purposes. These urns and boxes hold sacrosanct bones and bits of cloth from saints, canonized not by the Holy See, but a more ancient church. I suffer no conflict that they reside beside acceptably venerated bones. Bones are bones, and good people are good people. I beseech them all to watch over us in our time of need. I enter the raised chancel in the sanctuary and approach the lectern. We have no power for the microphone, but it is no longer necessary, as my voice will carry clearly to the few occupied front rows. 289 of us remain. I would weep if I had tears, but they are drained dry each dawn when I awaken, exhausted, stained by semen that is not mine by right, and guilt that is. Semen from one who has just dipped his fingers into the stoup of holy water, and now traces a cross at his forehead, his lips, his heart. He violates my sanctum. He mocks my rituals. His fingers do not burst into flame, nor is he struck by bolts of celestial retribution and banished to hell, as Satan should be. I believed him barred at the door. Was he amused to deceive me, or has he gained strength to project himself? He winks at me as he walks the center aisle. Near the rude screen, he pauses and unfurls his wings. Dark angel, black-winged and black-souled, in my church, in my church! The girls rustle. I become aware my gaze is fixed on Cruce, exquisite, naked Cruce, standing in the center of my chapel, wings spanning the aisle, stretching half to heaven, and my first emotion is panic. I must not let them know I see him, or Marjorie will stand in my stead. I sweep my gaze over the pews and lower my barriers so that I may know the state of their hearts. I've been muffling their emotions for months, for they have known such anger, grief, and fear of late that I cannot tender the daily inundation. Anxiety slams into me. Shame steals my breath. I press shaking fingertips to the hollow of my throat as if to release a catch hidden there that controls my inhalations. I see clearly for the first time in more than a month. If I am the only one who sees Cruz, I should be deposed. If I am not, if others see him too, and I have kept my silence this long, I should be damned. For what is war renowned? He divides, he carves down the middle, and makes enemies of even brothers and sisters, parents and offspring. War has been dividing my family since birth. Perhaps, indeed, he has been paying me uncommon attention. How best to divide? Sean's cousin Rocky kept a watch of gold and diamonds etched with his credo. He vowed, despite education, pedigree, or wealth, all prey fell indiscriminate to this simple strategy. Isolate the mark. Silence is the ultimate isolator. Have I played into his hands? He stands smugly certain of me, assured of our private complicity. How pleased he must be when each morning I remain an isolated berg in this winter that has claimed our world. I turn back to the women in my care. Who among you sees Cruz standing in the aisle? Riordan calls a meeting in one of the rooms on the second floor. I never seen such quiet in the club. Folks sit alone, not talking. The lights are dim and all music is off. I can't feel the tiniest vibration in my feet. A soft glow radiates at ceiling and floor level. He's got some kind of illuminated tubing behind the mouldings. I always assumed he had giant generators somewhere, and I just couldn't feel the vibration over the pounding, incessant music. If not generators, what's keeping the lights on? Dude, I thought you were turning everything off.
Everything is off.
What's powering the lights that are still on?
The bulk of Chester's runs on geothermal power.
I smack myself in the forehead with the butt of my palm. Of course, he's got all the best toys. Why wouldn't he dig all the way to the center of the earth and harness planetary power? The dude, like, lives forever. Me, Joe, Dancer, and Christian are joined by six of Riordan's dudes. Every time Jericho Behrens doesn't walk into the room with me, I heave a sigh of relief. One of these days it's going to happen. It's inevitable. And one of these days it will probably be with Mac at his side. School, I've lived most of my life under threat of one of these days, for one reason or another. Superheroes do. Riordan sends three of his men down to the club to keep order, and sends the other three into the icy day to track what noise they find and shut it down. Joe tempers his orders with, "And bring any people you discover back to Chester's, so we can keep them alive." I'll watch him real careful when she adds to his commands, like she has the right. Like she's his girlfriend, and they're a team, out to save the world together or something. We'll see if his dudes obey her. If they come back with a band of ragtag survivors, I might just be impressed. I can't read his face. It's like he's got it totally closed to me. He refuses to let me fire up a press and get a Danny Daly out. I argue, but Joe makes a point. Nobody is venturing out unless they absolutely have to anyway. So the time wasted printing and posting would be better used bringing everyone up to speed so we can make a plan. When did she become Ms. Voice of Reason? Oh, and Glam Girl. When she slips off her coat and unwinds her scarf. Her boobs aren't sparkly, but she's sure got a push-up bra on. Sound slurpees. Danny, what's going on? Joe says. It's being drawn by music, I say. At first, I thought it was attracted to singing, but it's not. It's a component of music it's after. Sound waves. Frequencies. Who knows, maybe a single note. And the sound doesn't need to be made by a person. It can come from a stereo, a musical instrument, church bells, a car radio. Even an unseelie screaming a note high enough to shatter glass.
Like at Dublin Castle, the night it iced the cages,
Christian says. He's been quiet, but I can feel temper rolling off the dude. He's barely keeping his cool. Exactly. Or it could be drawn by the chiming of crystal bowls.
The fitness center,
Riordan says. Right, or playing a washboard, banging on a pot and singing.
The laundromat, folks,
Dancer says. And the weird wire contraption around the dude's head wasn't a medical device for an injured neck. It was a harmonica holder, I say. With their primitive band, the small family managed to make whatever noise draws the Hoarfrost King.
The band in my subclub must have made it too. So why didn't it ice the entire club?
Christian says. I'm guessing it's drawn to a specific sound. The same way I like Life cereal, but not Chex. They're both little squares of crunchy goodness, but they sure as feck ain't equal to my taste buds. And all the audio equipment in your warehouse must have been hooked up and turned on. At the church where I almost died, they were singing and playing the organ. At all the underground pubs, there was a band or a stereo playing.
The We Care folks were singing and playing the organ too,
Dancer says. So how do we figure out what noise it likes? Joe says. All the scenes got blown up, didn't they?
I don't think we need to,
Dancer says.
We just need to set up somewhere and make an enormous variety of sounds. Wait for it to come. Great idea, kid,
Christian says.
Then we all bloody get iced. Not necessarily,
Riordan says. What do you mean? What are you thinking? Joe's slow-eyed puppy dog expression says she thinks he's the smartest person she's ever met. Gag me. Dancer's the smartest person she ever met, and I'm second. When he tells us, I just shake my head. It won't work, I say.
Actually, Mega,
Dancer says.
It might.
Bull fucking crikey, he's assuming a lot of things.
I think it's worth a try,
Dancer says. Are you defending him? I say.
Only the idea, Mega.
Are you sure you can pull this off? I ask Riordan. You know how many things could go wrong? Riordan gives me a look. Joe's gone white. You're crazy. You're talking about setting one monster free to destroy another.
The world is turning to ice,
Riordan says to Joe.
If this continues, the Hoarfrost King will finish what Crew started, the destruction of the world. Sometimes you plug the hole any way you can and worry about fixing the boat later. If the choices are sinking today or tomorrow, I'll take tomorrow.
Him and me think alike a lot of times. I'd never tell him that. To me, he says.
You and the kid get what we need. I want to be ready by nightfall.
I am blasted by the crimson complexity of Marjorie's rage. She surges to her feet to demand my immediate resignation as Grand Mistress, but before she can incite the hue and cry upon which she so thrives, one by one, heads bow and hands rise. White flags of surrender are hoisted until each woman has her arm above her head save one. My cousin reclaims her seat in the pew, fists clenched in white-knuckled balls on her lap. I open myself with a tight, narrow focus. Her fury is bottomless, directed in its entirety at me. She believed she was his only one. She castigates me for the wanton ways of our enemy. She is a fool in too many ways to number. In affairs of infidelity, if a man strays, it is not the fault of the woman with whom he lays. A worthy heart eschews temptation, despite the magnitude. Clearly, my heart is not worthy. I dismiss her and regard my girls with regret and resolve. In my silence, I failed my charges. It was not merely myself I isolated. I cut them off from one another. Did any of you tell someone else? I hear no replies, and need none. I can tell from their faces that not one of them spoke of it. We became a group of close-huddled islands in our shame, eating and working and living side by side, in complete disconnect. For more than a month, each of us waged the same hellish battle, and rather than sharing that burden, suffered it alone. We permitted him to separate us, I say. It was exactly what he wanted. But it is over. We have called his bluff, and are now united against him. Cruz's enormous wings rustle. It is the only sound I have ever heard the projected image of him make. Oh, yes. Our enemy is gaining strength with each passing day. Again, I wonder if it is Cruz or the presence of the IFP that causes the grass to grow. If it is the IFP, might its location above Cruz's cage also be weakening the integrity of those icy bars? I have not permitted myself to visit his chamber since last Sean and I made love. Failing my soulmate to anchor me, I'll risk nothing. Did this clever, clever prince devise a way to summon a fireworld fragment to set him free? Were I to make the long descent into the bowels of this abbey today, what would I find? Darkness, moss and bones, no bar where once one was.
Must we leave the abbey?
Tantiana exclaims.
Is it the only way to escape him?
It is our home. We can't leave. Josie protests.
Where would we go? How would we get there?
Dog sleds, Marjorie says. There aren't any dogs left. The shades ate them all, Lorena says.
That was a joke. The point is we can't leave, Marjorie says. Under any circumstances, this is our home. I will let no one drive me from it.
Again, I turn a tight focus on her. She wishes we would vanish. Doesn't care the how or why of it, so long as she gets him to herself. She has been in no way dissuaded by the fickleness of his affection. I dab at my neck, my brow. The temperature in the chapel is rising. I smell blossoms, spicy and sweet. I cannot move Cruz, but I can and will do something about the IFP. I must find a way to contact Riordan and his men. He already has my Sean. What more can he thieve from me? We will move the fireworld, send it back the way it came, and I will have my answer, if the grass dies. Fireworld or Ice Prince? Which is overheating our home? Did the fates cackle when they stitched together the tapestry that froze our greatest enemy in our basement, then parked a heater above it? I do not believe fragments of fairy are one way. If it can be tethered, surely it can be towed. 38. Burning down the house. Our exodus from Dublin is a somber one. It isn't easy to leave the city. It takes a small army of us to battle our way out. Before we go, we set up sound decoys at the north, south, and west edges of the city, in abandoned neighborhoods where nobody hangs anymore. Dancer hooks them up, broadcasting from a central radio source. Even Riordan is impressed, making me uber proud. Dancer is my best friend. Hopefully, it'll be enough to keep the Hoarfrost King from being drawn to all the noise we have to make in order to escape the snowy prison Dublin has become. I make a quick pit stop in the Cock and Bull Tavern and take something off the wall I've been dying to have ever since Dancer mentioned it. It's the only place I could remember seeing a whip, mounted like art, next to a set of giant bull horns. I got no doubt it'll come in handy somehow. And if not, so what? I can't resist making something move faster than the speed of sound. Sonic booms are so going to be me. Truck engines roar, scraping a path so Humvees and buses can lumber between snowdrifts, piled in enormous banks, iced solid as rock. Streets are impassable with the stuff, and still it falls, landing thick on our windshields. We got dudes up front driving snowplows, and trucks that scatter chunks of salt. I got no clue where they found the equipment. We don't get this kind of snow. Knowing Riordan, he's got all of it tucked away in a warehouse somewhere, prepared for any and every eventuality, even the seemingly impossible. Got to admit, I like that about him. I'm used to feeling like I'm the only one sees the hard things coming, and I'm always angling to skew the odds in my favor. It's nice to know somebody else is preparing too. He's right. The hole has to be plugged, because the boat is sinking. Another few days, and I'm not sure our exodus would be possible. We'd be iced in. I hate the plan we're about to put in motion, but we got to do it. Sometimes, when all hell's breaking loose, the only thing to do is to break more hell loose, before it's too late.
When we get to the Abbey and tell her what we're going to do, Cat's going to have a total meltdown.
Night brings a violet aurora borealis to our home. Aubergine and gentian flames flicker on shiny ice-capped snow, as if on the swells of an alabaster ocean. We gather at the windows of the common room to watch the dance of violet vapors. I am appalled to realize how much time I've spent in my chambers the past month, so as not to betray Cruce's visitations. I did not see we were all going off alone for similar reasons. Our abbey had become hauntingly quiet and lonely with me, their leader, unaware. I will never again permit myself to forget that isolation is the first step to defeat. Tonight, our unwanted visitor is conspicuously absent. It is the first evening in weeks he has not dogged my step. He knows we are angry, and his appearance would only further rile us. Marjorie, too, is absent. I will confront the wasp in our nest come morning. She and I will reach terms, or she will leave. Tonight, we break into our precious stash of corn sealed airtight in jars late last summer, popping it with oil over a flame. We make the evening a celebration, warmed by the last of the cider scalded over a fire, spiced with cinnamon and clove. Communion, warmth, good sense in the air, contribute to a feeling of thanksgiving and hope, and we reconnect into the family we once were with new appreciation. Now that we all know Cruce was plying his seduction upon each of us, we are no longer divided by guilt. When I hear the roar of engines approaching the abbey, I fear for the safety of my girls, and bid them retreat to the cafeteria while I see to the door. Three of those who served in the haven, Rowena's inner circle, refuse to leave, and another three step forward to join them. Tanti Nana at the forefront, her eyes wise in twin nests of wrinkles. They infuse me with courage. I begin to understand the purpose of the chosen inner circle. The seven of us bundle into cloaks, scarves, and mittens, and step out into the snow. Lavender lights wisp across the twilight terrain, evoking a surreal, dreamy ambience. We watch as trucks with enormous blades carve their way up our white-capped drive, followed by four Humvees and two buses. When Riordan steps down from the driver's seat of one of the trucks, for the briefest of startled moments, I think, but how serendipitous! I can ask him to tow the IFP away. Common sense asserts itself, and my heart grows chill. Yes, I wanted to see him, but for this man to come here tonight, for him to use machines to bulldoze a path through mountains of ice to reach our home, means we have something he wants, badly. Through narrowed eyes I regard him. Lack of visible cloven hoof, tail, or horns does not disguise the devil at my door. He glides, long-limbed and sure-footed, through the snow. He is a beautiful man, but unlike Mashan, the impression is of animal grace, something not human. Coupled, of course, with the fact that he is not really here. No man stands where he walks. I sense nothing. It is shocking. It is sensational in that it is the very antithesis of sensation. Loath though I am to admit it, it is such a relief. I get nothing from him. Never have I been around to anyone that affords me such blissful emotional silence. He takes both my hands in greeting and leans in to kiss my cheek. I turn my face, press my lips to his ear and say softly, "You can't have it. Whatever it is, you're not taking it. The answer is no." His breath is warm on my ear.
"I have come for something of which you'd like to be quit."
I wonder if he always speaks in the manner he has spoken to. The devil is the master of assimilation. It is how he gains entry. He makes himself appear a friend. Again, no. I think perhaps we have something to trade. Perhaps I will give him whatever it is he wants for moving the IFP, but best to deny from the onset. He slides his hands up my arms to my elbows and cups them lightly, drawing us closer.
"We could barter."
Does he read thoughts, or merely expressions, so well? "Give me my Sean back," I whisper. The stubble on his cheek abrades my skin.
Your beloved Sean has been free to leave for weeks,
he murmurs against my ear. I mask a tiny jerk and swallow a cry of protest. I do not know whether he speaks the truth. If it is a lie, it is a bitter and hurtful one.
It is not a lie.
He lets his hands fall from my arms and steps back. I am colder where he was touching me. I see Danny exiting one of the buses. The clouds part on my troubled heart, and I'm suddenly buoyant. Her fiery hair is a halo of sunshine around her glowing, delicate, eternally battered face. Her smile of greeting is infectious. How I have missed her. I open my arms, knowing she will never run into them as I wish, knowing any hug I steal from the child will be just that, stolen. Beneath her hardy, bruised exterior shines pure gold. She is filled with light as no one I have encountered before. It makes me both harder and gentler on her. Though she is cross and grumpy and irritable as any teen, there is not one ounce of ill will in her, and she has had reason to feel it. Indeed, reasons enough to fill a book. But she radiates only excitement and happiness to be alive. I realize Riordan is watching me watch her, intently. I wonder again if he can pick up my thoughts, and if so, how clearly. Why have you come? I demand. Danny skids to a stop on the ice in front of me and blurts in a rush of breath. Hey, Cat, what's up? Long time no see, huh? Everything okay out here? You got enough to eat and stuff? Sorry, I haven't been around to check on things, but I got stuck in Fairy. Dude, you're never going to believe all the stuff that's been happening. Oh, it's cold out here. Oh, and we think we know how to stop the Unseelie responsible for turning our world into an Arctic zone. Hey, I'm freezing. You gonna let us in? We are again in the common room, watching out the window as the most peculiar confederacy I have ever seen collaborate upon a shared goal prepares to destroy us. I cannot see it any other way. They are wrong. It won't work. It's far too dangerous. Five men who do not exist, one violent, immensely powerful, sex-obsessed, Unseelie prince who believes himself in love with Danny, an exceedingly radiant and happy Joe, and a young, good-looking boy with glasses for whom Danny is the sun, moon, and stars, and reminds me of Mashan, but harbors secrets so dark and deep that even my gifts cannot reach them, work together to unload equipment from the buses and carry it across mounds of snow and ice to the chosen location. While Danny told me of their plan to trap the Hoarfrost King with the IFP, Riordan remained silent, and with good reason. He knew each of my objections, and that there was no valid rebuttal for any of them. At the end, when permission should have been given or withheld by me, and it most certainly would have been withheld, he informed me that if I failed to cooperate in any way, he would destroy the Abbey and continue with his plan. You're going to destroy it anyway, I said. No, we're not. It's going to work, Cat, Danny exclaimed. You don't know that. You don't even know if the Hoarfrost King can be killed. Riordan's gaze reflected the same odds of success I perceive. He said simply,
How much longer do you think you and your charges will survive if this snow continues?
He has the most jarring way of never punctuating his questions. They plan to free a monster? I said, Assuming it works and the Hoarfrost King is destroyed, how do you plan to tether the IFP again? Even Danny had the good grace to look away. I cannot read Riordan. I will never be able to. But I can read the rest of them. Deep down, they do not believe they can. 39. Crystal world with winter flowers, turn my day to frozen hours. I ain't never been to a heavy metal concert, though I've seen some on TV. Dancers been to all kinds of shows. Growing up in a cage had serious disadvantages. By the time I got out, there were so many things I wanted to do that I couldn't get to them all. Now all the good bands are dead, and tonight is probably as close as I'm going to ever get.
The violet lights flickering in the sky are perfect for a rock concert. Like having our own laser show. I seen some on TV, and they were uber cool. It's crazy how many speakers and cables and stuff Dancer and me picked up. We might have gotten a little carried away, but the music store we looted was untouched and crammed full of equipment, with no windows broken and a full cash register. I guess in times of war, nobody's thinking. Gee, I want to go steal a stereo. In the end, we filled both buses, figuring the louder the better. We set up the sound stage close to the Abbey, between the wall and the IFP. It's freaky working close to it, knowing if anybody jostles you into it, you're instantly dead. Creeps me all kinds of out, but I got a job to do hooking up speakers, while Dancer gets everything else up and running. The long, wide, scorched black trail behind it is a constant reminder that it would char me to cinders if I so much as touched it. Although the IFP emits no actual heat, no snow accumulates on the barren soil, as if where it passed it has left the earth antithetical to cold. The faceted funnel is taller than the Abbey, at least 100 feet wide at the top, and tapers to 40 or so at the base, more than big enough to swallow one hoarfrost king. The earth beneath it is baked to a slick, shiny black finish, though the fire world fragment doesn't throw off heat. A ribbon of glowing wards twist around the base, securely tethered to a black loop on a black box etched with symbols about 20 feet away. I skirt the IFP, eyeing the black box suspiciously, thinking, how the feck is that tiny thing that is roughly the size of a Rubik's Cube keeping an IFP from drifting? It can't weigh more than 0.5 pound. I kick it gently to see how far it moves, and just about break my toe. I can't resist trying to pick it up. I can't even budge it on the snow. What? You got some kind of ultra-dense metal I ain't never heard of? I say grumpily, but if he hears me, he doesn't respond. How does Riordan always have the coolest stuff? Where the heck does he get it? I look back up at the funnel. It's eerily beautiful, crystalline planes and angles reflecting the dazzling purples of the Aurora Borealis. I will a silent thought to the universe. Let this work. We've all had a tough gig lately. Let there be no casualties tonight. Cat's outside again, watching us. Riordan told her she has to move the she-seers out into the snow once we begin. It almost made her nuts. She took it as the equivalent of him saying the Abbey was an accepted casualty. But I know him. He wasn't saying that. He just takes the possibles into consideration and knows that trying to move nearly 300 women in the middle of a crisis is a nightmare. I've tried to move them during times of peace and quiet and had the luck of a broken mirror nailed beneath an upside-down horseshoe with a ladder nearby that a black cat just walked under. Like sheep, she-seers herd by nature until you want them to go somewhere. Then they're all fluffy bottoms and broken legs. Since we're just about to start, I guess they're all inside bundling up. Freeze frame.